Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, talking today to Jeffrey Sterling. He's author of a book called Unwanted Spy, The Persecution of an American Whistleblower. But that's not what the Obama administration called him. Jeffrey Sterling served time in prison as a convicted leaker of classified information. His book begins by describing how Sterling grew up in segregated small-town Missouri. He earned a law degree and spent almost 10 years in the CIA, but he was fired after suing the agency for racial discrimination. Now, here's where it gets complicated. Sometime after he was laid off, Sterling told Senate investigators how a CIA plot against Iran's nuclear program called Operation Merlin had gone wrong. Then, 4 years after that, the Obama administration charged Sterling with leaking that story to James Risen of the New York Times. In his book, State of War, Risen had revealed Operation Merlin. It's a complicated scenario. We'll go over the plot points again as we talk. But first, let me welcome Jeffrey Sterling. Thanks for joining our program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You did more than 2 years in federal prison. You had a total sentence of 42 months, and you were still insisting you were innocent. What were you convicted of?
I was convicted of violating the Espionage Act and the unauthorized disclosure of classified information.
Specifically, what did that mean?
That means that they were charging me with speaking to a reporter, handing over classified information to a reporter, at that time. And right, ultimately, of course, Jim Risen. And so they accused me of being that as a leaker. However, I never did any such thing.
Why do you think you were really charged?
I think to make an example out of me, I was the easy target for the government, the DOJ, and certainly the CIA. I had complained about Operation Merlin through official channels. I had also sued the organization for discrimination. And I think they really wanted to make an example out of me.
What was Operation Merlin?
It was an operation designed to thwart or slow down the Iranian nuclear program. And the purpose of it was going to be done by instilling plans for key components of a nuclear weapon to the Iranian program. What they were not supposed to know was that those plans were flawed. As revealed in the trial, the CIA had worked with the national labs in developing the plans, instilling the flaw such that the Iranians would not have known. And then they would have implemented those plans into their program, into a weapon, and then it wouldn't work. And the theory within was that the program would be delayed or thwarted for a number of years.
Pretty clever sounding, but you learned pretty early on that it wasn't going to work. How did you learn?
Well, my job was to train and direct the individual we were using as an intermediary to turn the plans over. This individual no one was supposed to know that there was a flaw in these plans. And of course, I was given assurances that everything was okay, everything was working as it should. The first moment that the intermediary saw the plans, he immediately saw that they were flawed. And I made my concerns known at that time and was told to shut up, because to me, that meant that we were giving plans to them, which would not thwart their program, but shorten their timeline for having a viable weapon. Because to me, in science, a scientist is going to, if he knows there's something wrong, he's going to work to try to fix it. So if they saw that there was an immediate flaw in these plans, they would immediately try to fix it.
So that, in other words, instead of having them build a bomb that wouldn't work, it would make it easier for them to build a bomb that would work.
Absolutely.
And when did you reveal this to superiors, and in what way did they tell you to shut up?
Actually, the first moment was the moment during the meeting with the intermediary, our agent, Merlin, if you will. I let my superiors know at that moment and throughout afterwards. During that meeting, I was told to shut up And that was certainly revealed during the trial.
So it wasn't until after you were actually fired that you spoke to Senate investigators about this. How did that come about?
My concern was at that time we were going into Iraq. And, of course, I was removed from Operation Merlin, but also understanding and realizing the danger of that operation and what our soldiers could have been walking into. Yes, the operation was targeted at Iran, but it certainly could have been used for any other country that may have had nuclear ambitions. And so I just thought that that was something our policymakers should know about, and especially for the protection of our soldiers going into harm's way.
So you were still in the CIA when you spoke to the Senate?
Yeah, I was under administrative leave. I couldn't go. My discrimination case was continuing. And I was basically in limbo, persona non grata with the agency.
Now, James Risen subsequently got a lot of public praise for upholding the rights of the press because he refused to honor a subpoena to testify at your trial. He might have gone to prison himself. But do you think that if he had testified, he could have kept you out of prison?
I honestly don't think he could have, no matter what he said. I think the ball was rolling on that. That administration was being heavy-handed with use of the Espionage Act. And how the CIA was using that trial to save face, if you will. I don't think anything he could have said would have changed that. And I've certainly had to review in my mind, could, especially while I was sitting in prison, could this have been differently if Mr. Risen had testified and said that I wasn't his source? I don't think at that point it wouldn't have mattered what he said. That trial was going to continue. And I also think that the Department of Justice, the way that trial was run, they just pretty much had to show the one face that didn't look like any other CIA officer to convince that jury, and characterizing me as a disgruntled employee.
What do you mean by the one face in the CIA that didn't look like any other?
Well, just like with Operation Merlin, I was the only African-American face involved with that operation. The CIA, which I felt was extraordinary during the trial, put on current and former clandestine service officers, gave up so many sources and methods related to national security. And of course, every officer put forward had a glowing description. And I didn't look like any of them. They were all white officers. So it was easy to point me out as the interloper, the one that was different and the one who was the disgruntled employee.
So it sounds like you were a disgruntled employee if you sued for racial discrimination.
Well, absolutely. They did characterize during the trial that I lost my discrimination suit, and that was the furthest thing from the truth. My discrimination suit was dismissed or tossed out of court because, as the government argued, and the court believed that it would pose a threat to national security. So, you know, that's a big difference in saying that I lost my case. I mean, I was moving on with my life when all of this popped back up. But easy enough for them to say that I lost, even though that was not true.
Moving on with your life until all this popped up. Explain what you mean by that. That's an extraordinary way to put it.
Yeah, I had this ordeal has stretched over so many years. When I was fired from the CIA, I ultimately lost everything. I couldn't find a job within the intelligence community anywhere, even with my background and also being a Farsi speaker. It was amazing that after 9/11, no one would give me an interview or even talk to me. I had even made the effort to had my attorney reach out to the agency and say I would drop my suit if they would allow me to come back to help after 9/11. The answer to that was that I was fired. And so I essentially lost everything. I had to return home to my where I was raised. Eventually, I ended up being a nanny for friends who had just had a baby. So, and then I worked hard, got another job. I had another career. I was a fraud, waste, and abuse investigator for a major health insurance company and quite successful at that. And I had found a new love in my life, who would have been Holly, who would eventually be my wife. And things were going well. I had put all of that behind me. Until that day, the FBI showed up at my door.
And they searched the house.
Absolutely. They eventually did a search warrant. And another extraordinary thing about that, after the search warrant, it was another almost 5 years before I was indicted.
How do you explain those amazing gaps in time?
The whole ordeal has been hard to explain. During the trial, the FBI agent who was investigating me through all these years, admitted that at one point, years prior, the investigation had been dropped because they admitted they had no evidence. That was the previous administration to Obama. The Obama administration came in, and I think they saw this as a great opportunity to continue with their use of the Espionage Act.
As a sort of cruel irony about this, it seems to me, because you were suing for racial discrimination, and of course, the Obama administration was led by an African-American man. And of course, the Attorney General, Eric Holder, was an African-American man as well. And he was very outspoken about your case.
Yes. I think for then-President Obama and Mr. Holder, it seemed to me, and of course, I'm having this viewpoint from prison.
Sure.
An aspect that Mr. Obama, even throughout his presidency, didn't want to seem like he was especially giving any favoritism to African-Americans or treating them any differently. I think with my case, it was a great make an example of him resource for that president to see this is what we do, what should happen to those who use race as, for vindictiveness, which certainly was not the case with me. It was essentially a show trial, and the trial really became the discrimination suit that I had wanted to bring forward years earlier, except this time I was not able to say anything about what I faced at the agency, but all of the witnesses by the government that were put forward, of course, had negative things to say about me or that I wasn't part of the group. Aspects like that. And I remain to this day really disappointed in how things turned out with him, Mr. Obama, as president. And again, sitting in prison, seeing the individuals that he then pardoned in the same realm of things that I did, he had more to say for his friends and others than me.
General Petraeus was one of those. Explain the difference between your situation and General Petraeus's.
I think that I did nothing. There was an abundant amount of evidence indicating what Mr. Petraeus had done in violation of his agreement to keep things classified and secret. But I was not within the high levels of government, and to be point blank, I was not white.
So you say you did nothing. Did you ever speak to James Risen before he published his book that revealed Operation Merlin?
Absolutely. When I had filed my discrimination suit, Mr. Risen was with the New York Times, and he wrote an article about my discrimination suit. So there had been a previous relationship between the two of us. And during the trial, it was revealed that I had revealed no classified information in that article with Mr. Risen. But then they characterized me of being vindictive. Afterwards, I disclosed all this information to Risen.
So allegedly, then, you did that afterwards and helped him to put together that book. Did you, in fact, just tell us right now, ever say anything to him about, or anybody else other than the Senate investigators, about Operation Merlin?
Absolutely not. I went through, and that's the other curious thing with the trial. Every step of the way, and when I went to the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the government, maybe that wasn't their purpose, but they demonstrated how I followed the rules every step of the way. Yet all of a sudden, I was the prime suspect for leaking this information. mainly on initially because I had a relationship with a reporter that disclosed it.
Were you unable in your trial to bring forward anybody who could speak on behalf of your service at the CIA and say that even though you had sued for racial discrimination, you'd actually done a pretty good job?
Yeah, I mean, and again, during my trial, there was no indication of it having any negativity in my file for any aspect. During the trial, they really didn't talk about much about there was a witness or two that said I was not living up to my requirements as a case officer. But it was difficult to try to find individuals who would speak on my behalf. There's, of course, fear of reprisal doing stuff such with the agency while still there. But the case was such that even having that opportunity, even to impeach those witnesses for the government about it, we were not allowed to do those sorts of things.
Did you like working for the CIA and being a case officer aside from the racial discrimination that you experienced?
Yeah, absolutely. I was the pride I had at joining that organization was tremendous. And I certainly didn't join the CIA with closed eyes. I knew about the history of the place, but I also knew that, you know, the integrity that I had, you know, growing up and becoming an adult to be with the CIA, I wasn't going to allow that to change me. So maybe I could have been able to make some positive change within the CIA, but of course we will never know. But I am proud of the service that I was able to accomplish and also proud of how I was, the steps that I took to bring to light dangerous aspects of the agency.
There's almost no detail at all in your book about what you actually did, the assignments that you had for the CIA, and I assume that's because the CIA had to vet every word of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I did have to submit this through the Publication Review Board, and I did so. The process was surprisingly not that difficult, I think, because most of my career was disclosed by the government during a public trial. The history of authors having difficulty with books being approved by the agency. But I, again, went through the process. There were a few instances that could have been contentious, but in response to their, quote, concerns, I certainly sent them copies of the trial transcript to show that what I'm talking about was freely discussed by the government, not me.
What did you do? What were your assignments?
Well, I was a case officer, so I was my job was to go out and recruit spies to provide information of interest to our national security. So I had some world appointments. I worked also in the States, as was disclosed during the trial, and I talk about a little bit in my book. But I think I had a really good career. I was very good at my job. And that's why it was surprising to me the discrimination that I ran into. They were disregarding all of the things that I had accomplished. But all of a sudden, as I was starting to move up in the ranks, it became a concern of theirs that my skin was dark.
You were good enough to learn Farsi, not an easy language to master, while you were working with regard to Iran. What did you do, and in what way, or who did you speak Farsi to?
Well, my job, of course, was when I was with the agency, one of the main areas I worked with was the Iranian task force. So as a case officer targeting Iranians, it certainly makes sense to learn that language. So my job was to go out and find Iranians who may provide information that I wanted to get my hands on.
Did you have to betray people, make friends with them, and then, you know, turn them in some way, or did it work that way at all?
That wasn't my experience. And certainly when you think about it, you're asking somebody to provide you information that they have most likely promised not to divulge to anyone not authorized to hear that information. So, yeah, I mean, generally you can work with some unsavory characters. I value the relationships that I was able to form during my job. And I also wanted to make sure that they were protected. They wouldn't have had the same outlets of protection that I would have had. But I wanted to, you know, I was very careful with my job. I understood the risk that these individuals were going through working for me. So I also made sure that, you know, they were being protected as well. That's, again, why it was surprising during the trial the CIA was so willing and the DOJ was so willing to give up sources and methods and even had Merlin's wife on the stand and Merlin himself via video. But I never would have done anything like that. Had my discrimination suit gone forward, there would have been no reason to disclose such classified information.
Okay, so you were doing what you regarded as a really good job. Nobody said you weren't doing a good job, and yet you were prevented from rising because, you say, of the color of your skin. How do you know that? What evidence do you have for that?
Well, it was at a point where I'd had enough, and I was not receiving the tools that every other officer was receiving to do their job successfully.
What kind of tools? What do you mean?
The necessary tools for cover, to be able to operate effectively as a CIA case officer. Without the proper cover, you can't get into the right doors. And I asked why I was not receiving those tools and why I was not receiving opportunities for a promotion. And point blank, I was told by my then supervisors that I kind of stood out as a big black guy speaking Farsi. That, you know, to this day, I cannot believe that that was told to me. But it was. And it was a thunderclap to me and quite shocking. And my only response to that was, when did you realize I was black? And why should it even make a difference? I've already proven myself, yet now you taught me Farsi. I learned Farsi while at the agency. So all of a sudden, you know, I'd already proved that I could go in different places in the world and no one ever did suspect that I was a CIA officer. I didn't fit the profile. But all of a sudden, I'm too big and black to be effective as a case officer.
Well, just to ask an argumentative question, are there a lot of big black guys who speak Farsi?
I may have been one of the few when I was in the organization. But again, not fitting that generally accepted profile of a CIA officer, I was able to go places in the world and do things that other officers would have had more difficulty doing. But yeah, the agency will say certainly that the diversity numbers are classified. But while I was there, there were not many African-American case officers, certainly.
What do you mean when you say that you needed cover, but you weren't given cover? What kind of cover did you want? What do you mean?
Well, you want cover that will open doors for you to get to those targets of value.
Do you mean by that an identity, a false identity that you would assume?
Yes. Some sort of cover of working with some government organization that would allow you to at least get in the same room as individuals. As I say in my book and disclosed in the trial, the cover I had was little more than a janitor. I had no backstopping. I had no real support. Just given a little piece of paper that said, you know, essentially, I'm a janitor. Opened absolutely no doors for me.
We're talking with Jeffrey Sterling, who's author of a book just released called Unwanted Spy, The Persecution of an American Whistleblower. We're going to talk more with him, particularly about his early life, much of which is described in the book, after we take a break. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To The Point, talking to Jeffrey Sterling, author of Unwanted Spy, The Persecution of an American Whistleblower. Tell us a bit. You said earlier that after you got fired, you were in such terrible condition that you had to go back to the place where you were raised. And the book begins with a long description of what your early life was like. Tell us a bit about it.
Where I grew up, there was such a small town in Missouri, such a divide between white and black. And it just didn't seem like there was that many opportunities for blacks or even that African-Americans there would be even expected to do anything in life other than menial jobs or things like that. And that was difficult for me to accept. I mean, I had a lot of brothers, a big family, but I just, the things that I saw in Cape, I just knew there was another world out there.
Cape was the name of the town.
Cape Girardeau, yes, in southeast Missouri. And I just knew that there was a world out there, and I wanted to see that world, and a world that, you know, racial discrimination or racial lines weren't the norm or readily accepted as a standard operating procedure or how to live. I didn't want to be a part of a society, and I knew the world out there that, you know, I would be judged on the content of my character and not the color of my skin. So it was a struggle because I took an interest in things that weren't typical for blacks where I was growing up. So that put me in a world where there weren't that many blacks, the types of classes that I took in school. So I felt the ostracization from the other side because all of a sudden here's this one black face among whites. So they view me as an interloper, again, someone that didn't belong. But I just struggled with all of that, but I persevered and kept going.
How did black friends feel when you joined the CIA?
Well, of course, I didn't know. I joined the CIA undercover.
You don't tell people that.
Yeah, no, when I joined. And the only reason my cover was removed as part of the punishment within the agency before my discrimination suit was even finished, my cover was removed, backdated to my entrance on duty. But when I did join, I certainly didn't tell anyone. I said I was working with a government agency in D.C. That's where I was moving to. And so I entered the world of the clandestine service, if you will.
But you'd already been a lawyer. Tell us a little bit more about your family, your mother, single mother, your many brothers. I think you were the seventh son, if I'm not...
Yeah, I at that time I had five brothers. I was the youngest. One brother had been stillborn. So yes, I was a seventh son. My mother, her and my father were divorced when I was five. And she raised all of us, single working mother. I would always get inspiration by watching her. I remember she would tell me the story, and I loved hearing the stories about the struggles and their perseverance. You know, she just, you know, not receiving support from, my father. So she just said one day she's going out and find a better job, a good job. And she did exactly that. So a lot of that stick-to-itiveness and just working hard I got from her. We weren't poor. I had clothes. I had food to eat, presents during Christmas. So I had what I felt was a good life other than the pressures of race growing up. But... Then, of course, as I describe in the book, there's then my mother had legal issues. She pled guilty to embezzling funds from her job. And that was a hard blow for me. Here was the paragon of life to me. I mean, I didn't have a father growing up, but she was my rock and my strength. But then... seeing that and learning about that, that felt like that was going to be a blow to me, you know, something else to deal with. But, I was as supportive as I could have been. But, but you have to make decisions at some point, especially in life, in which direction you're going to go. But I did support her as much as I could. But I also had to continue with the dreams and ambitions that I had.
Extraordinary conflict, it seems to me, with your mother on the one hand inspiring you to do better and seek the kind of life that was different from where you grew up, and on the other hand, a confessed embezzler.
Yeah. So that was a tremendous blow. I was in college at that time. It was a hard introspection for me. Would I at that time quit college or continue with my studies? And though things had changed for her, I knew, and what she instilled in me was, you keep going. You fight through. And sometimes you have to make hard decisions. I never left my mother and any interest with her, but at the same time, I had to choose my own path.
You said that you weren't poor, you had food and you had housing, and yet you also describe the first time that you saw a white neighborhood and saw a different kind of house, different pavement on the streets. Elaborate a little bit on that, because I think the distinctions are really important.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in Cape, again, very stark racial lines. The areas where I grew up in Cape, the roads weren't taken care of that well. Police presence was the norm. You know, broken bottles on the street, street lights not working and things like that. Houses that weren't taken care of. And as I grew up, high school, met friends and would go visit them. You know, very immaculate neighborhoods, streets that were taken care of, businesses around that, the things that you see on TV, you know, they were in the white neighborhoods, but not in the neighborhoods where I grew up. And I didn't like that disparity. It didn't make any sense to me. I viewed it that we were all citizens of the same town. Why were we being treated differently? You know, during the winters, the streets in my neighborhoods would not be plowed, yet the streets were always clear in the white neighborhoods. So, you know, just seeing those distinctions, and it was hard to see, and also just didn't make any sense to me.
Well, were you then especially sensitive to the issues of racial discrimination when you got into the CIA?
Absolutely. I knew going in. Again, I walked into the CIA with eyes wide open. I knew there weren't that many African Americans within the CIA. And of course, I was given assurances that I was going to be treated equally. I even had, when I first joined the organization, a black employee who had been there for many years. His question to me, and I described this in the book, was, you know, what are you doing here? And he was essentially telling me, you know, that I didn't have a chance there because I was black, and I could go off and do something else, or I should have gone off and done something else and have a better time of it as opposed to the CIA. And I took exception to that because I knew I was just as good, just as qualified as anyone else there. And if I had that opportunity to prove it, then I would be accepted. And that I wouldn't be treated differently because of the color of my skin. And as my career developed and as my time there continued, I certainly learned that the equality that I was guaranteed was never the case.
And you think then that what happened to you in the CIA and the fact that you did not rise was, as you indicated, said to you that you stood out because you were a big black guy, discrimination was at the root of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was when I was with the Iran Task Force, I was the only black face there. Many of the operations I was involved in, I was the only black face involved. And so that's why, again, it didn't make, and I was proving myself all along the way. So it didn't make any sense while I wasn't receiving recognition for any of the work that I was doing, not giving the same opportunities. And the only reason was because I was black. And of course, I have the distinction with that they actually told me to my face that I wasn't being treated the same because I was black.
And if you didn't have adequate cover, you weren't able to do more than you were able to demonstrate simply because you were artificially restricted.
Yes, absolutely. And as came out in the trial and during in my book, I describe how I was not provided the same tools as everyone else, yet expected to do three times more than those individuals, those officers, those white officers, if you will, who had the proper tools. And I was expected to do three times more than they were.
So subsequently then, when the CIA was looking for what you describe as an easy target to retaliate against after the revelation of Operation Merlin and how it had failed, and after the Obama administration was looking around for somebody to punish, I presume you think, for being a leaker, you ended up in prison. Tell us about that.
That was very... probably one of the lower times in my life. growing up, because I had seen, it almost seemed like the norm that black men, especially where I was growing up, had spent time in jail or even in prison. That was one of the longest running nightmares I've ever had in my life. And being in prison was living my absolute most horrible nightmare. It was terrible. I did feel like, of course, that I was tossed aside, thrown out of the country that I love. And then with that emotional aspect, then just dealing with the desolation of prison, it was quite disheartening for me and very hard to get through each day.
What about the way the prison was run, and what did that teach you about the justice system, federal particularly, in the Department of Corrections?
Yeah, prisons, you know, we read about conditions in prison and things that are horrible about prisons, and anything that you read that's bad about prisons is absolutely true. They're little more than warehouses, human warehouses to toss bodies aside. My direct experience with the dismissiveness about just lives in prison was, you know, I essentially had a heart attack in prison, yet it was a struggle to receive adequate health care. Thanks to the efforts of my wife, Holly, who eventually got a U.S. senator involved, I finally was able to receive health care. And why should anyone have to go through extraordinary measures to receive health care in prison? Another aspect that just didn't make any sense to me, and I had direct impact with it.
Because of who you were and your experience, were you in the kind of prison that people describe as country clubs? And if so, why did it take a U.S. senator to get you health care?
There was absolutely nothing country club about the prison where I was housed, if you will. It was prison. When I got there, of course, it being a low security prison, I had so many telling me that time was easy there, that if you could go to any prison, this would be the place to be. And I had to tell them that, you know, I have no reference for that. And it's still prison. I was away from my family. The care was lacking. And you're not really treated like a human in prison. You're just treated like the number that you wear.
And you wanted to be close to your home in Missouri, and yet you were sent to Colorado. Do you think that was done intentionally in order to further make you uncomfortable, I guess, would be one way to put it?
I think so. The regulations, of course, say that there's a certain mile radius or whatever that someone should be sent to from their home. I was sent beyond that mile limit. And it was a struggle for my wife, Holly, to come visit. But thanks for the generosity of others, she was able to visit me about once a month. But I think it all was part of, let's just continue punishing Jeffrey Sterling, as the judge said, because she felt I didn't fess up to the charges. And it's like, well, I didn't do it. So why would I admit to something that I didn't do? But the entire process, the criminal justice system, is just to punish. There is nothing, I think, redeeming about how individuals are treated in the system.
So what you're saying is you didn't fess up to what you were accused of doing because you didn't do it. But what you did do was sue the agency for discrimination, and you think they were retaliating against you as well as finding an example of somebody they could use to demonstrate that they were trying to battle the problem of leakers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What's the difference between a leaker and a whistleblower?
Well, of course, that's been in the news a lot lately. And I do appreciate that there's been more discussion, more attention on whistleblowers. But I think it's also showing the negative side of it. As I've said on numerous occasions, when the subject of a complaint controls the dialogue on what is or is not a whistleblower, well, there are no whistleblowers. There are only leakers and spies. So as we continue the discussion, maybe we can start changing that dialogue.
The subject who controls the situation at the moment, presumably, is President Trump. In your case, it was the CIA.
Absolutely. And there's so many eerie similarities to this current the whistleblower or whistleblowers that I went through when I went to the Senate Intelligence Committee. As I read with the this current whistleblower case, is that once the individual made the complaint, the subjects of the complaint, the White House and the Attorney General, were informed of the complaint, essentially giving them a heads up. That is exactly what happened to me when I went to the Senate Intelligence Committee. What I didn't know was that at the time was that those staffers had a current relationship with the CIA. And it became clear during the trial that instead of writing a report about what my concerns regarding Operation Merlin and turning that over to the members of the committee, they went straight to the CIA to give them the heads up. And so I think, again, just eerily similar to what I went through. And I think that shows the problems that we have in whistleblower protections.
And were the alleged whistleblower protections in effect at that time? Did the Senate staffers essentially violate them?
I think they absolutely violated them. They disclosed at the trial that they went to the CIA. There is no report written up about my conversations with them. Again, I had no idea at that time or even during a trial if they had even bothered to let the members of the committee know about the concerns that I had raised. I was given assurances that the information that I told them would be confidential, would be discussed with the members of the committee, but that absolutely did not happen. There were absolutely no whistleblower protections for me, even though the regulations for whistleblowers have been on the books for a good while. When I went, none of that was followed.
After they informed the CIA, how long did it take you to find that out? Were you retaliated against immediately, or do you think it was just more of the case that was sort of being made against you because you had sued for discrimination?
It did take a while for me to learn of what transpired after I had gone to the Senate Intelligence Committee. But during the trial, it seemed that after I went to them, Operation Sterling, if you will, had taken shape. There were so many resources within the agency that were basically pointing the finger. Sterling did this. He's the one who leaked the information to Jim Risen. During a trial, there was absolutely no one else investigated, even though it was revealed that there were hundreds of individuals who had full knowledge of Operation Merlin. Almost immediately. I didn't know that, of course, at the time. But as I learned through the trial, I was suspect number one, only suspect.
We just had heard a reference to Operation Sterling. Remind our listeners, we're talking with Jeffrey Sterling, whose book is called Unwanted Spy, The Persecution of an American Whistleblower. Do you know of other people within the CIA that did talk to Jim Risen about Operation Merlin?
I did not know of anyone who would have discussed anything with Mr. Risen. But the curious thing, during the individuals that I spoke to, the staffers that I spoke to at the Senate, one of them had been subsequently let go for leaking classified information to a reporter, and that reporter, as disclosed in the trial, was Jim Risen. Yet that made no difference in my case. But I didn't know of any other agency employees that had any contact with Mr. Risen.
When you were ultimately fired, the man with the message was none other than John Brennan. He wasn't head of the CIA at the time, but he did have a very, very high office. How do you explain his appearance, and where was it?
It was in an outbuilding, because at that time I was not allowed to, my ID had been taken away, so I was not allowed to enter any of the main buildings. So it was an outbuilding for processing, and I was made to believe that it was such an honor and so out of the ordinary for someone with Mr. Brennan's level to come to let someone know that they've been fired. I did not feel that it was an honor at that time, certainly. And that just, I think, highlighted just how odd all of it has been during my time with the agency and trying to fight against racial discrimination.
How do you compare yourself to Edward Snowden and Julian Assange and people like that who have also been described as whistleblowers, although under very different circumstances?
I'm not sure I would be comfortable making any comparison to anyone else other than, you know, it takes a lot to say no or say enough. And maybe that's the common thread. And of course, whistleblowers are giving information that is important, you know, for the public to know. Just giving it, leaking out information about the next iPhone, I mean, that certainly isn't within the realm of whistleblowing. But information that the public should know, they should know about the wrongdoings or questionable activities of their government. So I think the only common thread is maybe saying enough. I mean, there's certainly been others out there, John Kiriakou, Reality Winner. So what I would like to see is equal treatment for whistleblowers. Let's not just focus on the whistleblower. Let's look at what the whistleblower is revealing. And maybe instead of just having protections because it's politically expedient to do so.
Should point out, though, that you did nothing, or you claim you did nothing, despite the fact that you were convicted. You did nothing to let the public know anything about classified information.
Absolutely not. I revealed everything as I was instructed or allowed to do, the proper channels.
One of the great accomplishments of the Obama administration, of course, at least by some people's standards, not President Trump's, was the Iran nuclear deal. You were involved in Operation Merlin, which was an attempt to foul up the Iran nuclear program. Do you think that what happened to you had anything at all to do with trying to publicize that accomplishment by the administration, or that it was involved in any way indirectly?
Compartmentalization being what it is, I certainly had no direct knowledge of that, but anything is possible. There's so many ties, and even with the Obama administration and General Cartwright, the information that he freely gave up about Iran and programs against Iran. So maybe there is a connection to all of it, but I had no direct knowledge of any of that.
What are your reflections now after the extraordinary life that you have led? You're still not an old person. About the United States and about the justice system and about the role of racial discrimination?
I've certainly seen the wrong side of America, and certainly the criminal justice system. I went to law school and learned the ideas of law and the rule of law in this country, and certainly of equal treatment. When I joined the CIA, I certainly believed in the mission. I still believe in the mission of the CIA. But when you're thrown into the system and then you see how it works, and that it's not operated in an equal way, that becomes quite disheartening. And as I said earlier, I've hit some quite a few lows, certainly being in prison, wondering, did I make the right choices in life? And I just know I never would I have changed anything that I've done. I'm proud of what I've been able to do and the steps that I've taken in my life. It hasn't turned me off from my country. I still love this country. I always will, always have. While I was in prison, I was given, you know, the outreach of support, showed me the America that I thought had tossed me away, and that reaffirmed my love and belief in my country.
You were warned by another very unusual African-American member of the CIA when you first got there. You were asked, what are you doing here? With the assumption that, or the presumption that you were going to be discriminated against, and of course you were. How deeply ingrained in the CIA is the kind of racism that you experienced, do you think, and what sort of reforms need to be made?
I think the racial lines in the CIA are well ingrained, and I think that's the culture. And it needs to be changed because an organization of the CIA should use the resources that are available. And people of color are available as vital resources for such an important agency. I think there needs to be more oversight of the CIA. Remove it from its lofty on high position of being untouchable, and let's remove that veil of secrecy with what the CIA is doing. I think we as citizens have a right to do that. And having worked within that organization, I think that there's a lot that needs to be revealed, because only through when the lights are turned on do you see what's going on, and that's when change can happen.
Well, the CIA has had this sort of special status, untouchable status, since it was founded by Alan Dulles way back when. Does it deserve the respect and the independence that it has?
I think it does deserve respect, but regardless of its position and what its history has been, it's not above the law. It's not above the citizens who it is organized to protect. So there's a lot that the CIA can be commended for, but because of its position in dealing with national security doesn't mean it should be untouchable.
Would you advise a young African-American man, particularly one who's graduated from law school and has a lot of other opportunities, to join the CIA?
Of course, I've been long removed from the CIA, but I would kind of doubt that the strides for diversity and equal treatment have been that obvious. But I would feel hard in telling a young African-American not to join the CIA. That is certainly a way to serve your country. But I think there also has to be that realization that you can and you very well may run into a situation of being judged not by what you're able to do or your qualifications, but by the color of your skin. I think if you have your eyes wide open and know that that's a possibility, then it can still be a place of value to work. And maybe if more apply and join the CIA, more positive change can happen.
We will leave it at that. The book is called Unwanted Spy, The Persecution of an American Whistleblower. The author is Jeffrey Sterling. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Previtari. You can catch all of our To the Point episodes on your favorite podcasting app. And do this, contact us on social media, tweet us at @ToThePoint_KCRW, leave a review, or tweet me directly at WarrenAlney1. We want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. Thanks for being with us this time, and do come back again.